What's the tie-in between nanotechnology and infectious epidemics? We'll continue the discussion with Douglas Mulhall in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Douglas, what's the tie-in between infectious epidemics and nanotechnology?
Well, George, I'm glad you brought that up because we're starting to get some emails on this from your program. And
already?
Yeah, and if people actually, we have a website on this, it's calcify.com, and it's up on your website, that URL as well.
Yeah, let's take some time to talk about all this now because health is, you know what, people really care about this.
Yeah, I was really interested to see all of the emails that were just generated in the last few minutes. What was George talking about at the top of the show? Well, let's talk about what was published today by the World Health Organization, a really landmark study that there's been a lot of talk about this over the last few years, but the World Health Organization has never done a formal study on it. But now they've published this study forecasting that 400 million people will die prematurely from chronic illnesses over the next 10 years. And they're talking about illnesses. When they say chronic illnesses, they're talking about heart disease, diabetes,
cancers.
That's correct. So these are chronic. These are the illnesses of aging, basically. That makes these chronic diseases the biggest epidemic in human history, far greater than the AIDS epidemic or the flu epidemic that killed 50 million people in 1918. We are talking about the biggest single drain on the world economy. And the way that this is manifesting itself, George, and boy, I know that a lot of listeners out there know this, is that as employees, for example, are growing older and are retiring, companies like Ford and General Motors are doling out like $1,300 per car sold to support the health care plans for their employees. And then you're starting to look at airlines, four of which are now in bankruptcy. What are they doing? The first thing they're doing is they're slashing their health plans.
Right.
Their health plans.
So first thing to go.
And what we are watching right now across America is the wholesale disenfranchisement of millions of Americans from their health plans because as we are living longer and we are getting these chronic illnesses, our health care plans and end of pipe treatment is simply incapable of dealing with the carnage, with the result that we are in a gradual bankrupting of the healthcare system that is threatening the foundations of our economy.
It's like broken levees, Douglas.
It's like broken levees, and I cannot overemphasize the seriousness of this problem because it is, in terms of costs, it makes Iraq look like a party. I mean, this is really major stuff, and it's going to get a lot worse unless we can do something about it very, very soon. And I'm getting to your question about the relationship between infection and nanotechnology, but I wanted to just give the big picture there because it's extremely important to understand how important infection really is. And that relates to the second big story that has come out this week, and that is the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Medicine, and it was awarded this week to the discoverers of the cause of stomach ulcers.
That's right.
Now, what do stomach ulcers have to do with infection, and you know what's all that about? Well, here's what it has to do with infection. In 1982, two Australian researchers discovered that stomach ulcers are not caused by stress. They are caused by bacteria.
Yes.
And if you take a two-week course of a cocktail of antibiotics, in most cases, you will be cured. Now, here's the interesting thing. The common wisdom of all of the medical experts at the FDA and the NIH and everywhere else in the world in those days was that no bacteria could possibly live in the stomach because the stomach is a sterile place, made sterile by these tremendously strong stomach acids. Mm-hmm. Therefore, these two scientists had to be idiots because no bacterium could possibly exist there. What was the result of that common wisdom? The result of that common wisdom was that their reputations were mercilessly attacked, virtually destroyed, and despite proof being published in recognized medical journals, they were simply ridiculed, and the medical community completely ignored this proof for more than 10 years. It even took one of these discoverers, he got so desperate that he actually swallowed a beaker full of this bacteria and got deathly ill, and thereby proved that this bacteria caused this illness. Mm-hmm. And the really weird thing is that they asked them, well, when did the tide begin to turn in your favor? And one of the scientists remarked, well, actually, you're not going to believe this, but it was a story in the National Enquirer. And it was when the National Enquirer took on the issue of stomach ulcers being caused by infection that the whole thing started to get serious attention amongst U.S. medical authorities. So go figure. But anyways, that's the way it happened. And why is this so important for infection? Because stomach ulcers were always regarded as a chronic illness. And the mantra in the medical community for the past 50 years has been, chronic illness cannot possibly be caused by infection. It's got to be caused by something else. And stomach ulcers were at the leading edge of that argument. So these guys actually proved that that mantra is wrong, that chronic disease can indeed be caused by infection. Now, if you fast forward to today, you see another type of confirmation of this idea that chronic disease is caused by infection. And that has to do with cervical cancer. And it has been discovered that when you prevent the human papilloma virus from multiplying, you can prevent cervical cancer. And this, again, points very strongly to infection as a cause of chronic disease. So here you have the beginnings of this kernel of knowledge that actually these chronic illnesses that are getting us as we grow older are not the result of some mysterious process, but in fact are the result of infectious processes that then open the door to other things taking over and other bacteria piling on, and then, you know, once we get weakened, all kinds of other things take over.
I'm beginning to think that these bacterium are one of the main reasons why so many people feel melancholy every day, just don't feel good.
Well, then you come to this issue of, okay, what is the common denominator that runs through the majority of the diseases on the leading causes of death list and the majority of diseases that cause serious inflammation and discomfort today? For example, arthritis, which won't kill you, but it sure can cause a lot of misery. Diabetes, which can kill you, mm-hmm. Heart disease, breast cancer. What is the common denominator that ties all of these things together that is perfectly visible on an X-ray or a CT scan and that doctors have been known about and that thousands of studies have been done on, but no one has ever been able to figure out what causes it? That common denominator is something that has been misnamed as calcium deposits, but in fact is calcification, which is the combination of calcium and phosphorus put together. And if you can believe it, this calcification is found in every one of the disease conditions that I just mentioned, and it is very well known, for example, to radiologists because they see it on CT scans and x-rays every day, to the point where they don't even bother telling doctors about it anymore. And the reason they don't bother telling doctors about it anymore is because doctors haven't known where this stuff came from or how to get rid of it. Now, when we're talking about this calcification, we're not talking about the healthy stuff that makes bones and teeth, and we're not talking about the calcium that is essential for the functioning of every cell in the body.
Right.
And is essential to life. All of these things make calcium an extremely important player, and of course phosphorus as well. You can't have life without calcium and phosphorus as we know it, that is. So a very small percentage of this calcium and phosphorus is mysteriously used by the human body to do really nasty things to us. And it does three things in particular, which are really a problem. The first thing is it clogs up your arteries something awful. It can constitute at least 20% of the plaque that is in so-called hardening of the arteries.
See, and so many doctors in the past, or maybe even still, would say it's cholesterol.
Yeah, it's cholesterol, even though half the people that die of heart attacks don't have any cholesterol problems, but never mind. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if anyone has actually seen a real-time image of arteries and veins in the body, they'll notice that they're pumping all the time. They have to be extremely flexible. Well, guess what calcification does? It just wrecks that flexibility and just makes it a whole lot harder for them to, you know, push that blood through and to do all the things that they have to do. So number one, blocks you up. Number two, ruins the flexibility of all of your capillaries and all of your arteries. And number three, and here's where we start to get into the infection issue. Just in the past few months, a group of scientists who've been working on calcification for many, many years and are very well respected, they've gotten funding from the military and from the NIH and all kinds of other institutions, made a major discovery about calcification that counteracts all of the conventional wisdom that cardiologists have been told for the last 20 years and have been telling their patients. And that conventional wisdom is that calcification has nothing to do with inflammation. Now, a quick primer on inflammation. For anyone who's read the cover of Time Magazine or Newsweek in the last year, they will know that inflammation is the new bad boy on the block in terms of causing heart attacks and causing all these chronic problems. And inflammation has been identified as, you know, the big troublemaker. But cardiologists have always looked at calcification in the arteries and said, no, calcification has got nothing to do with inflammation. Rather, it has to do with, as you mentioned, this cholesterol and this feedback mechanism of these lipids. Well, guess what? These scientists at the University of London published in one of the leading cardiology research journals that they have proven beyond a doubt that calcium phosphate crystals in heart disease cause inflammation, end of story. Now, that is a big discovery, although did you read about it anywhere? No.
Nope.
Even though it was published in one of the major heart journals in the United States, it has gotten virtually no coverage. And why is that important? That's important not only because inflammation generates heart attacks and other serious problems in the human body, including a continuous immune response. And that's what you're talking about people being tired all the time. You've got this continuous immune feedback. Why? It's a response to an infectious process. That is one of the hallmarks of inflammation. It's a response to infection. Now, when we start to talk about nanotechnology and the relationship to infection, guess what? About 15 years ago, a group of scientists working at the Scripps Institute in La Jolla, in California, discovered a tiny little infection that has since come to be known as nanobacteria.
Nanobacteria.
And this was, they didn't discover this, they weren't looking for the cause of heart disease or anything else, they were actually looking for something quite different. What they were looking for is why in all of these sterile media that were being used to develop biological products like vaccines, for example, why the mammalian cells that are used to develop these biological products were dying. Why should they die in sterile serum? It just didn't make any sense. Or they were stopping to reproduce. And this scientist actually guessed that there was something in there that needed a longer incubation process under special conditions in order to show itself. And sure enough, and here's the funny part, because, you know, penicillin was discovered by accident when a Petri dish was left out. The scientists who found the cause of stomach ulcers actually discovered the bacterium by accident when they left a Petri dish out over a holiday. And this scientist in La Jolla discovered this nanobacterium by accident when he left the thing in an incubator for 28 days.
So, sounds the secret is forget what you're doing.
The secret is forget the Petri dish. And so what happened was he came up with this slimy kind of biofilm and realized that there was something growing in the supposedly sterile serum. And then when he put it under a strong microscope, he realized that there was a particle in there. And then he started collaborating with another scientist, actually a Turkish PhD graduate. And while they were working together in Finland, of all places, they discovered that this infection, this nanoparticle, had one particular trait that ties it to all of these chronic diseases that we have been talking about.
All of them.
All of them. It creates a rock-hard calcium phosphate shell that is identical in composition to the material that is found in hardening of the arteries, in kidney stones, in stones that are found in the dental pulp in our teeth, in prostate stones, in breast cancer, in ovarian cancer, and in about a dozen other chronic illnesses.
Probably kidney stones as well.
Kidney stones as well. And so that brings us back to this issue of nano and infection, because the only way that they have been able to discover what this thing really looks like, seriously, is with scanning electron microscopy that can actually see down to the nanoscale. And they have been able to identify in quite a bit of detail now, remarkable photographic detail. And some of these actually haven't been published yet because it's quite recent. The most recent photographs of this show quite clearly this calcium phosphate shell surrounding this lipid core. And here's the remarkable thing about this particle. It is a mystery because it doesn't seem to contain the necessary DNA to self-replicate in ways that are normally known. It just doesn't. But despite that, they have proven that this thing self-replicates, that this thing propagates, like you would see cells multiplying, but it doesn't seem to do it in the same way. And the other thing that they have proven on numerous occasions is that when you inject these particles into, for example, mice and rabbits, they get kidney stones. And that is known as something called Koch's postulate, which was developed as a procedure in order to prove that an infection causes a disease.
If I recall from the calcium bomb, this nanobacteria can be killed.
That is correct. Well, what happened was they, in order to immobilize this thing, they had to go in the lab and figure out a couple of things. The first thing they had to do was figure out how to get this rock-hard calcium shell off it. And I just want to say that one of the reasons why medical science has missed this thing for so long is that, well, first of all, we needed the technology to be able to see it. And the second thing is, we needed to be able to figure out how to get the calcium phosphate shell off of it, and maybe I can explain that.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back, Douglas. Also, I want to talk with you about the term first used by Eric Drexler in his book, Engines of Creation, gray goo. Those of you who are saying, what did he say? Well, you'll find out. Well, we're going to talk about how you can break down this calcification and also gray goo. Ever hear that phrase before? We'll talk about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Douglas Mulhall, our guest. Douglas, tell us a little bit about how you can break down these shells around the calcium.
Right. And George, again, we've gotten a couple of emails from people, and they're asking us where they can find a physician in their area that knows about this.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say that if you go to our website and just go to our contact form and email us, we can put people through to the right contacts on this. And I also want to emphasize, by the way, we're not connected with selling any products related to this. We have chronicled this discovery, and we're independent writers on this. But we can tell people where they can find out about this. So if they go to calcify.com, and they send us an email from the contact form, we'll definitely get back to them, and we won't send them any junk mail.
And honestly, after reading the book when you were with me in November, this is not a very complicated process to eradicate, is it?
Well, it's...
If you get the right practitioner who understands this, when you're talking about antibiotics and the substance that you use to kind of flush this stuff out,
well,
it's not difficult.
Well, here's the remarkable thing about it. When they were looking at this, these two scientists, and by the way, the two scientists are Dr. Alavi Kayander, who... was really the discoverer of nanobacteria. And when I say nanobacteria, the interesting thing is that they actually misnamed it because they've since discovered it's really not a bacteria. It is something else. It is some other type of particle that propagates in a way that is not completely understood. So people shouldn't get the wrong idea that this is a bacterium, because it actually... is something else. It's
so
not a virus.
This is the new information.
That's right. It is not a virus. It has some form of unique structure that allows it to do this, and we'll get to that in a moment. But answering that question, the other scientist, by the way, before I forget, is Dr. Neva Shivsholu, and she is currently running the nanobacteria laboratory at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, Johnson Space Center in Houston. And they are extremely interested in nanobacteria for a reason that I'll explain in a moment. But the first thing that they had to do was to immobilize this thing to study it. And so they tried a number of chemicals. And one of the things that they found was that this thing was extremely resistant, for example, to high heat, to radiation, to antibiotics. It was resistant to all these things, which explains partially why calcification hasn't been affected by any of these things. However, what they did was they decided to try what's known as a chelating chemical. And a chelating chemical is basically something that grabs minerals and you can excrete them from your body. For example, there's a chemical known as EDTA, that has been approved by the FDA for many, many, many years for dealing with lead poisoning in children. And it's also approved by the FDA, by the way, in the thousands of tons as a use as a food preservative to prevent food spoilage. So it's been well known for years, and it's been well known that this stuff grabs calcium and calcium phosphate and can help to get rid of it. And so what they did was they first applied this EDTA, and then they applied an antibiotic once they had stripped off the calcium phosphate shell. And that was the trick. So here you have, for years and years, the medical community has been experimenting with antibiotics and heart disease. And what have they found? They found that antibiotics have absolutely no impact on the rate of heart attacks. There have been studies done on thousands of patients showing that, well, there seems to be some temporary impact, but actually in the long run, the impacts on the rate of heart attacks with antibiotics alone has been virtually nil. And on the other side, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding the use of this EDTA on in something known as intravenous chelation, which, as I said before, has been used effectively for lead poisoning in children, but then it was used in off-label prescriptions, for example, to deal with heart disease, and there's been a lot of controversy over, you know, whether it has been effective. And at the moment, no clinical trial study has really shown an effectiveness of EDTA intravenous chelation in reversing the number of heart attacks. So here you have a case where you've got two very well-known chemicals and drugs on their own, mm-hmm. have never been shown to be terribly effective in reducing the level of heart attacks. And they put these two things together in order to, in the lab, immobilize this particle and take it apart and try and figure it out, and realized at that point that they had the beginnings of a treatment. They used other chemicals too, by the way. They used something that is known as bisphosphonates, and they also used other chemicals. But the problem with these other drugs and chemicals is when you use them in the human body at those levels, they're toxic. Right. And so even though there are many different ways of immobilizing this infectious particle, they really couldn't use them on human beings because, you know, you'd cure the disease but kill the patient.
Sure.
So they decided, and actually there was a third player in this. There was a physician's assistant in Tampa, Florida, who had been using a chelation and observing it for quite some time and realizing that, you know, it seemed to be working for a while with patients, but then they just didn't work any. It didn't work with them anymore, and they seemed to get worse. And he studied this for quite some time, and he combined it with nutraceuticals, and it still didn't happen to do the trick. And one night, he was surfing the internet, and he came across this website of these two scientists in Finland who had been working with this nanoparticle, and he realized that what he had been missing from this was the antibiotic component. And so he put the two of those together, the EDTA and the tetracycline, and a third group of nutraceuticals that have been shown in clinical trials, for example, to reduce inflammation. And lo and behold, he started to realize that some of his very ill heart patients were improving when they normally would be dead. Hmm. In other words, these were last gasp patients who really had run out of all other chances with their bypasses and their stents and their seven heart drugs that they were taking for the rest of their lives. And when he saw that, he hopped on a plane immediately over to Finland and corralled these two scientists and said, look, I think we've got the beginnings of a treatment for heart disease here, and I would like to try and get a clinical trial started on this. And this was sometime around the year 2000.
Okay.
And they thought he was nuts. They said, you know, come on, you're telling us that your heart patients are getting better? He said, yes, I've got a few patients that are really getting, they're improving, and they're very ill.
Didn't really know why at the time, his guesses.
Well, then he understood in the lab what they were working with was this infectious particle, and that it was having its covering stripped off, and then its core immobilized, and he just put two and two together. And also, here's the important thing, and we'll come back to this in a minute. These chemicals are well known. They've been around for more than 50 years. They've lost their patents, and so they're relatively actually inexpensive to use, which has been part of the problem in getting the rest of the industry to adopt this approach, but we'll come back to that. The point was that he convinced a group of cardiologists in Florida to do an initial clinical study on some very ill heart patients. And that clinical study was actually completed in 2003 and published in the journal Pathophysiology in 2004 by Dr. Benedict Maniscalco and a colleague of his, Karen Taylor. And that study basically showed for the first time in a published study that the combination of EDTA tetracycline and this nutraceutical had succeeded in measurably reversing the calcium scores, And a lot of people will know that term because billions and billions of dollars are spent these days measuring people's calcium or calcification levels on these CT scans. It's called a calcium score. And those scores have never been effectively reversed because no one ever knew how to get rid of calcification. Lo and behold, this first clinical study showed that on average, the responders, which were basically two-thirds of the patients, were having a 14% reduction in their calcium scores. But more importantly, their measurable symptoms of heart disease were improving. And for example, even patients who were on statins, which are these fairly strong drugs that are designed to, you know, reduce heart disease and reduce angina symptoms, even patients who were on statins were showing a very significant reduction in angina. In fact, more than 85% of the patients experienced a partial or complete absence of their angina that they had been having for years and years. Also, the other measurable symptoms, such as the chemical measures and stress tests, right, were showing significant measurable improvement.
Will this be the next Nobel Prize for medicine?
Well, you know, I think the question to ask before that, George, is, are we going to have to go through another decade of seeing people cut open, like they cut open the stomach ulcer patients for 10 years, denying that infection was the cause of this?
Well, when did you publish Calcium Bomb?
Well, the Calcium Bomb was published basically at the beginning of this year. And here, I'm very glad that you mentioned this, because we have been crisscrossing the United States for the past 8 months talking to patients and doctors about this issue. And I need to talk about one thing I think that's very important, because a lot of people hear about this and they go to their doctors and they say, have you heard about this? And the response is, not only have I not heard about it, but I don't want to hear about it, and I don't want you to hear about it because it's all a bunch of hooey. And then the patient goes, but I understand that there have been clinical studies published, and I understand, aside from this heart study, that there has also been a study published by the Cleveland Clinic and Dr. Daniel Shashkes, who is one of the leading urologists in the United States, showing that men with prostatitis whose other drugs had failed were, in the majority, showing significant improvement in their prostatitis symptoms when treated with this same approach. Have you heard of that? No, I haven't heard of it, and I don't want to hear about it, and it doesn't work. This is, and what's happening is that patients are loath to offend their specialists. They're loath to offend especially their cardiologists. And so what's happening is that people will actually walk hand in hand down the road to the grave with their cardiologist rather than offend them. And this is proving to be a big barrier to having doctors and cardiologists at least have a serious look at this treatment and talk seriously to the cardiologists who actually have some experience with it. And this has been a big barrier. So the reason that we wrote this book, The Calcium Bomb, is so that patients could read it and arm themselves with the knowledge and take it to their doctors and say, please inform yourself about this. And by the way, you know, if you're not going to inform yourself about this, I'm going to find a doctor who will, because there are several hundred physicians across the United States who are prescribing this approach right now and who are watching their patients in the majority improve. And we interviewed a number of them. And George, I have to tell you a couple of stories because I think a lot of your listeners will relate to this. And one in particular, in Washington, D.C., I interviewed a guy this summer. His name is Peter. And he's a father of 8 children, runs his own cleaning business. He's a real entrepreneur. He's an immigrant, a Brit, and he's a tough kind of guy. And 3 years ago, at the age of about 63 or 64, he had angina. He had severe pains. He went to his cardiologist. The cardiologist did an angiogram, and he said, Peter, you've got blockage in all the arteries leading to your heart, and if you don't have bypass surgery in the next 2 weeks, you're probably going to die. And Peter, being the strong-willed guy mm-hmm. that he is, said, you know, I think I'll take a second opinion on that. So what he did was he went out and he started taking this intravenous chelation that I had spoken about earlier. And he got worse. He got a lot worse. He started having his angina attacks all the time.
All right.
And So he said, oh my goodness, what have I done to myself? You know, I'm really going to have to, you know, have this surgery.
He probably thought he was killing himself.
Right. And then he found out, he saw an article by Dr. Steven Sinatra, who's a very well-known cardiologist, who had written about nanobacteria. And he found a physician in the Washington, D.C., in Virginia, in his area, who had been prescribing it. And he started taking the regimen. And I have a written testimonial from both him and his physician stating clearly that in 6 months, his angina had abated completely. He was able to go back to work full time. And I sat down with him 3 years later, watching him wolf down a sandwich at Subway's in D.C. And here's the important thing about Peter, why he's such a good example. Because he never, ever took a single heart drug and never had any heart surgery at all. And his calcium score was reduced by 20 to 30%. His angina was completely abated. And as far as he was concerned, he was experiencing a significant reversal of his heart disease. Now, I wouldn't give that kind of anecdotal example if it hadn't been confirmed by this initial clinical study that had been done. And so what we did was we found this throughout the country. You know, we interviewed, for example, Dr. Douglas Hopper in Los Angeles, where you are, and he has a diabetic patient who had open heart surgery, then had a heart attack after the open heart surgery. He put her on the nanobiotic treatment, and her heart function went from 27% to over 50%, which is considered normal. It's called your ejection fraction. And she is basically back at work and is actually going on a TV program with him next week to talk about this. So here you have these examples popping up across the country, and here's what's really important about it. For people who have had their bypass surgery and it isn't working, who've had their stents and their stents are plugging up, and who've had their six or seven heart drugs and it's not working for them, finally there is something that has published evidence behind it that they can go and they can take instead of walking to the grave slowly.
What if it is working for them, all those things you mentioned? Will this just make life even better?
Well, it has. The main thing that it has done for the majority of patients who took the clinical trial treatment is it has measurably improved their quality of life. Now, it hasn't worked for everybody. There are still about 20 to 30% non-responders.
Has it made anybody worse?
There were a few patients who had increases in their calcium scores. But here's the interesting thing about that. When calcium scores start, they really start, calcification starts in your teens. For example, young soldiers who've been killed when they've done the autopsies on them, they found these calcium phosphate streaks in them in their teens. So that's when it gets started. And it multiplies very slowly, which is why at the top of the show you said, you know, it's a very insidious type of disease because it takes so long. It multiplies only once every 2 or 3 years. Okay, so when you're in your 20s and 30s, if you have a quarter of a millimeter multiplying to a half a millimeter, you don't even notice it. But when you're 45 or 55 and it's going from 1 millimeter to 2 millimeters, and on top of that, is generating all of this inflammation that we were talking about, then you have a real problem on your hands. And that's why some people can go to the doctor, you know, not show any symptoms of heart disease, and 3 months later walk out and have a heart attack. Because once the doubling reaches a certain point and these calcium phosphate crystals get to the surface and can rupture in this soft plaque, that's when you can have these types of thrombosis developing and these sudden deaths from heart attack. And keep in mind that half of all fatal heart attacks happen in people who show no prior symptoms.
And did you say you have a list of doctors who practice this on your website?
We don't have it on the website because we don't like to, you know, expose them to everybody who just looks at the site. But we will tell people how to get in touch with them if they tell us what area they're in. We'll refer them to the individuals who can then give them the information.
Gray Goo next in phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.